Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly, Brian Lynn, and Steve Ember. But first, this report from Jonathan Evans.
Students around the world wanting help with the TOEFL English test have a new tool, a mobile app. The TOEFL official app became available last week. Users can download it from the Apple App Store or Google Play. TOEFL stands for Test of English as a Foreign Language. Students must pass the test to get into many universities in the United States and other English-speaking countries. It is made up of four parts: reading, listening, writing, and speaking. Test takers will be able to use it for everything from registration and test preparation to receiving their scores and requesting health-related accommodations. What we wanted to do through the app is to meet them where they are on their own terms and schedule and on the devices they increasingly prefer to use, said Srikant Gopal. He leads the TOEFL program at the Nonprofit Educational Testing Service, or ETS. After downloading the app, users can get material to help prepare them for the test. They can also register to take the test. And, the organization says, users can see their test scores and send reports to schools they wish to attend. Students also can search for the test centers near where they are, as well as find open seats for the test. This works through Google Maps. The app will be available everywhere in the world, except China. Gopal said that TOEFL has a very different registration system and a very different kind of arrangement with the Chinese authorities. Companies in China must go through the Chinese National Education Examinations Authority. TOEFL has not decided yet whether it will work on such an app for China. The TOEFL program has also introduced several test-based changes in recent months. It has been cut from 3.5 hours long to 3 hours long. The new, shorter test started in August. TOEFL has reduced the number of questions in 3 of 4 parts of the test. The same language skills will be tested, and scoring stays the same as well. The test preparation materials will be changed over the next several months, but all the existing official materials can still be used because the test content has not changed. The reading section now includes 3 to 4 passages with 10 questions each. The section takes 54 to 72 minutes. The listening section now has 3 to 4 lectures with 6 questions each, as well as 2 to 3 conversations with 5 questions each. The section takes 41 to 57 minutes. The speaking section now has 4 questions instead of 6. The section takes a total of 17 minutes. The writing section remains unchanged. It has two essay questions, which take a total of 50 minutes. Also, the 10-minute break between the listening and speaking parts of the test remains the same. Test takers will now be able to get their scores more quickly. Students taking the test after October 26 can get their scores online in 6 days instead of 10. The official score report will now also be sent to colleges and universities as early as 9 days after the test date. Another recent change is the so-called My Best Scores. The company permits test takers to use the highest scores they have achieved on each part of the test. The scores must be from tests taken within the last 2 years. Students can use the app to send these My Best reports to universities. The My Best score shows not just the student's performance in one single test, but their potential over time, Gopal said. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We can also tell where they come from. And probably more importantly, for those learning to speak English, we explain how and when we use these terms. Reading is a popular activity for people all over the world. There is nothing quite like getting lost in a really good book. It can be a special experience. Minor problems melt away as the characters in the story seem to come to life. The best part about books is that they can take you anywhere you want. They can take you to places that do not even exist. We can also understand the world around us and its people better by reading stories. So it is no surprise that Americans sometimes use expressions involving the word book. Today, we will talk about two such terms. Both use the two main verbs you need when talking about a book, reading and writing. Let us begin with an expression from a reader's point of view. The following example sounds like an enjoyable activity, reading someone like a book. Yet to read someone like a book means that you know the person very well, and usually not in a good way. We often use this expression in special situations. A person may be trying to trick you, but you know their true objectives. In other words, you can see through their attempts to fool you or someone else. Now, let's hear how this expression is used in this exchange between two coworkers.
Were you able to get him to agree to the deal?
No, he didn't sign the agreement.
Without his signature, we cannot make the movie.
Don't you think I know that? I thought it was a sure thing. He said he was really interested. So I took him to dinner. I spent a lot of money on a bottle of wine. I even offered him front row seats to that sold-out show next weekend.
And he still didn't sign.
If you ask me, he had no interest in signing the contract. He just wanted a free dinner and more.
Yes, he read you like a book.
So that is an expression with the verb read. Now, let's turn to one with the words to write. When you become an expert at something, you may write a book about it. After all, many experts write about what they know. They want to share their expertise, or make a name for themselves, or both. In any case, we use the expression to write the book on something to describe a person who knows a lot about something. and this person does not need to have published an actual book, but it can be funny to tie the two together, like in the following example.
What's keeping you so busy these days? I haven't seen you in weeks.
I am studying for my exams on building materials, but I'm having a lot of trouble. I'm not sure what materials are the best or worst for natural disasters.
You should talk to Madeline.
Madeline? Is she good with building homes in disaster areas?
Are you serious? She is the leading expert on building for natural disasters, from earthquakes to hurricanes.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. She wrote the book on the subject, literally and figuratively. In fact, do you want to borrow her book? I have a copy.
Yes, and please give her my number. I would love to pick her brain.
And that's all for Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Kelly Jean Kelly for Ana Mateo.
Weather experts say Taiwan and the Philippines have experienced fewer typhoons in recent years. The reduced storm activity may be the result of higher water temperatures and changes in upper atmosphere winds. Taiwan, which sits in the western Pacific, normally gets hit hard by 3 to 4 typhoons each year between the months of June and October. Each storm can kill 5 to 10 people and can cause major damage. Taiwan's neighbor to the south, the Philippines, can get up to 20 typhoons per year. The storms bring winds strong enough to blow down trees and rainfall that can quickly turn streets into rivers. They usually cause mass evacuations and widespread transportation problems. The systems are called cyclones and hurricanes in other parts of the world. For the past 3 years, Taiwan and the Philippines have missed their historical average typhoon counts. Weather officials say one of the main reasons for this is higher water temperatures in the mid-Pacific, where such storms form. In addition, wind directions have changed in the upper atmosphere and are blowing more typhoons to the north. Jason Nichols is an international weather expert with U.S.-based forecasting company AccuWeather. Nichols told VOA that weather officials have seen a general warming of waters in the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific in recent years. Nichols added that ocean temperatures in the central and eastern Pacific Ocean have been warming up since 2017. He said this caused typhoons to form in areas to the north and east of Taiwan and the Philippines. Upper atmosphere winds pushed the storms north. Most of this year's 21 typhoons in Asia moved north to reach Japan, South Korea, and China. The most severe, Typhoon Hagibis, killed 80 people in eastern Japan earlier this month. Western Pacific waters have been somewhat cooler this year, Nichols said. This means fewer storms have formed near the eastern coasts of Taiwan or the Philippines. Asia's deadliest storms each year often reach the Philippines, including 2013's super typhoon that killed 6,340 people. So far this year, no major typhoons have hit the country. It has experienced weaker tropical storms, however. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. During the first half of the 19th century, leaders of the United States could find no answer to the question of slavery. The dispute grew more threatening after the war with Mexico in 1849. Northern states refused to permit slavery in the new territories of California and New Mexico. Southern states declared that they had a constitutional right to bring slaves into the new lands. The South was ready to secede, to leave and break up the Union of States. Then, in 1850, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise to avoid secession and a likely war between the North and South. He said the Union was permanent and created for all future Americans. He attacked the South's claim that it had the right to leave. He warned the war that would follow Southern secession would be long and bloody. 1 week after Senator Clay spoke, Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi explained his position. He did not say much about Clay's proposed compromise. Davis was sure that no good would result from it, not even from stronger laws on the return of escaped slaves. Davis said what was needed was a change in the North's policy toward the South. He said the North must recognize the rights of Southerners, especially the right to take slave property into U.S. territories. Davis said Congress had no right to destroy or limit this right. He admitted that the old Missouri Compromise of 1820 had limited the right to take slaves into the territories. He said the 1820 Compromise worked not because Congress passed it, but because the states agreed to it. Senator Davis said the North was responsible for the growing split in the country because the North was trying to get complete control of the South. He said if these efforts were not stopped, the North someday would be powerful enough to change the Constitution and end slavery everywhere. Davis warned the South would never accept this change. 3 weeks later, the Senate heard another Southern leader, Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. For years, Calhoun was the voice of the South. He now was 68 years old and a sick man. He spent the last week in February writing what he believed to be the true position of the South. Many senators understood it would be his last speech. On Monday, March 4th, the Senate was crowded when Calhoun entered. One by one, friends came to speak to him. The old man's long, gray hair fell to his shoulders. His face was thin and white, but his eyes were bright and his jaw firm. Calhoun was too weak to read his speech. He asked another senator to read it for him. Calhoun said that for a long time he had believed the dispute over slavery, if not settled, would end in disunion. Calhoun said it was clear now to everyone that the Union was breaking apart, that the ties that had held the North and South together were breaking one by one. Three churches, once united across the nation, now were split between the North and South. The major political parties, he declared, were divided in the same way. Calhoun said the North was responsible for all this disunity because it had destroyed the political balance between the two parts of the country. As the population of the North had grown large, he noted, that part of the country seized political and economic control. The North passed tariff bills the South opposed. It had filled most of the offices in the federal government. It closed the new territories to Southern slaveholders. And, said Calhoun, it viciously attacked the Southern institution of slavery. The situation was so bad, he said, that the South could not, with honor and safety, remain in the Union. How can the Union be saved, he asked. Not by the compromise proposed by the senator from Kentucky. There is but one way, a full and final settlement with justice of all the questions disputed by the two sections. The South asks for justice, simple justice, and less she ought not to take. She has no compromise to offer but the Constitution, and no concession or surrender to make. She has already surrendered so much that she has little left to surrender. At the end of Calhoun's speech to the Senate, Southern lawmakers crowded around the old man, congratulating him. But many of them could not agree with his demands and the violence of his words. By now, most Southerners believed that Senator Clay's proposals were a reasonable way to settle the difference and protect the Union. Yet Clay worried that Northerners might reject his proposals. Many in the North felt slavery was wrong. They opposed Clay's compromise because it might permit slavery in New Mexico, and because it called for stronger laws on the return of slaves who had escaped to the North. So Clay asked an important senator from the North to speak in support of his proposals. Daniel Webster represented the northeastern state of Massachusetts. Senator Webster believed that slavery was evil. Yet he believed that national unity was more important. He did not want the nation to divide. He did not want to see the end of the United States of America. Webster was 68 years old as Calhoun. 3 days after Calhoun's speech, Webster spoke to the Senate. His voice was weaker now, but his words rang with the same strength as years earlier. I speak today, he said, to save the Union. I speak today out of a concerned and troubled heart. I speak for the return of a spirit of unity. I speak for the return of that general feeling of agreement which makes the blessings of this Union so special to us all. Senator Webster spoke of how he hated slavery. He spoke of his fight against the spread of slavery, but he disagreed with those who wanted laws making slavery illegal in new territories. It would not be wise to pass such laws, he said. They would only make the South angry. They would only push the South away from the Union. Then Webster spoke about the things the North and South had done to make each other angry. One, he said, was the failure of the North to return runaway slaves. He said the South had good reason to protest. It was a matter of law. The law was contained in Article 4 of the nation's Constitution. Every member of every Northern legislature, Webster said, has sworn to support the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution says that states must return runaway slaves to their owners. This part of the Constitution has as much power as any other part. It must be obeyed. Next, Webster spoke about abolition societies. These were organizations that demanded an end to slavery everywhere in the country. I do not think that abolition societies are useful, Webster said. At the same time, I believe that thousands of their members are honest and good citizens who feel they must do something for liberty. However, their interference with the South has produced trouble. As an example, Webster spoke about the state of Virginia. Slavery was legal there. Webster noted that public opinion in Virginia had been turning against slavery until abolitionists angered the people. After that, he said, no one would talk openly against slavery. He said abolitionists were not ending slavery, but helping it continue. Then Webster said the North also had a right to protest about some things the South had done. He said the South was wrong to take slaves into new American territories. He said attempts to expand slavery violated earlier agreements to limit slavery to areas where it already existed. Webster said the North also had a right to protest statements by Southern leaders about working conditions in the North. Southerners often said that slaves in the South lived better lives than free workers in the North. Webster appealed to both sides to forgive each other. He urged them to come to an agreement. He said the South could never leave the Union without violence. Webster said the two sides were joined together socially, economically, culturally, and in many other ways. There was no way to divide them. No Congress, he said, could establish a border between the North and South that either side would accept. In general, Webster's speech to the Senate was moderate. He wanted to appeal to reason, not emotion. Yet it was difficult for him to be unemotional. His voice rose as he finished. Secession, he called out. Peaceable secession. Your eyes and mine will never see that happen. There can be no such thing as peaceable secession. We live under a great constitution. Is it to be melted away by secession, as the snows of a mountain are melted away under the sun? Let us not speak of the possibility of secession. Let us not debate an idea so full of horror. Let us not live with the thought of such darkness. Instead, let us come out into the light of day. Let us enjoy the fresh air of liberty and union. Northern abolitionists quickly criticized Daniel Webster's speech. They called him a traitor. But most people of the North accepted Webster's appeal for compromise. His speech cooled the debate that threatened a complete break between the North and South. Yet the speech was not the end of the debate.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.